you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Rob Sutton, the SDR Show. This week, a true musical pioneer, genius, unique individual, Devin Townsend, comes on the show. We have a great conversation. Really super cool dude. Learned a lot. Very, very interesting guy. We do the show every Wednesday, every Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Next two episodes, just so you know, this one and next week, no Big J. Why? We are going to the AVNs, and what are you going to do? We pre-recorded this episode. That's the truth. Remember, you can go to gasdigitalnetwork.com, use the code SDR. If you were a fan or are a fan of Devin Townsend, you could have heard this 5 days earlier, commercial free, at gasdigitalnetwork.com using the code SDR. Try it out for a week. Don't like it, cancel it. Charged nothing. But really, all we care about is you getting the word out. So here it is right now, the Devin Townsend episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show.
It is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me, very close to the camera, is James Madden. How are you?
We're having real issues here, Bubba. I'm trying my damnedest.
I appreciate
it. We haven't done the Zoom in a minute.
I know.
James. I forgot I got a goddamn spaghetti bowl for my equipment, and it's too late to redo it. It's going to be amazing.
I will say this. I'm somewhere in the middle in terms of quality, and on the 180 of you, this guy that is just the way I'm going to describe you this way, sir, and you may agree or disagree, but I was talking, as I told you off air, Scott Evil is a good friend of mine for years who does rock radio for a long time. I had the show called Metal Mania. I described you to him as he really is the heavy metal Frank Zappa. Would you agree with that or disagree with that? Or you don't like the comparison, but I will say it is a legend, Devin Townsend. How are you, buddy? How do you feel about that description?
Well, first off, there's a bunch of thoughts. Number one, thank you. Number two, I'm well. Thank you for having me. Number three, I think the proximity of the camera that James employs really accentuates the cleanliness of his pores, which I, for one, thoroughly appreciate.
And when it thank comes you, my to friend. Zappa, I'm glad someone appreciates it.
I'm here for you, brother. In terms of the Zappa thing, I mean, it's a hard one because I think there's not a lot of competition in that arena now with my genre, so I it's like easy for people to default to that based on several aspects of my career, like the productivity or maybe the, you know, the humor aspect or whatever. But on a personal level, I always thought he was really brilliant, much more so than I, but emotionally we were coming at things from a different place. I was always much more interested in Zeppelin and Motorhead rather than than the more classical side of things, although I do appreciate it. I've always thought that comparison was,
is that a very standard, is it a standard comparison?
Not standard, but it implies like a connection to somebody who's brilliant in ways that I'm not, that I find a little awkward, especially knowing and working with a lot of the people that worked with him and knowing his kids and everything like that. It's like two different ideas.
I get it. But it's very flat. You might be too close to it to truly get it. I like the forest and the trees kind of
maybe,
shit, but I get it.
I liked his fart joke songs, right?
Yeah, for sure. Me too. So here's the funny thing. So we're going to get into the new record and a lot of other stuff, but I have to bang out some stuff first because, I mean, how often do we get to talk to Devin Townsend, right? And so number one, which you recently turned 50 during the pandemic, right? And I watched an interview that really spoke to my heart. And what this is that at some point recently you realized, along with me, you really don't like listening to loud music anymore. You don't like being in that crazy environment that you unfortunately are going to be in by default. I elect to not do this stuff anymore. I have stepped down from hosting music festivals because I don't want to be around that anymore. But the other part of it is how you start realizing how creature comforts are so important. And I listen to you go on a diatribe about another thing that's so important to me, which is a fucking bidet. So, yes. Boy, are we like kindred spirits already.
Oh, buddy. My butthole is like a tomato tortellini that's been boiled for 3 hours. Like, it's puffy, perfectly clean. I mean, I would say when it comes to loud music, it's a hard thing as well, because like you say, you can elect to remove yourself from it. But there's a certain humor that is not lost on me, that my job that I chose for myself as an 18-year-old that wanted nothing more than to see the world burn through music has now manifested as a 50-year-old that's just like, oh my God, everything is just too much.
And researching bidets, like, if the 18-year-old of you would beat the shit out of you.
I don't know about that, man. I've got two of them now. And I find that it's like almost, and I'm very happy you brought it up immediately, because almost my first port of call conversationally with people I've just met is like, oh, so your name is, oh, it's great to meet you. Very cool. Yeah. So what do you do for a living? Great. Have you ever used a bidet?
You know, we had a Nonpoint on the show in studio. I have a studio nearby, and I forget which guy in the band was late to the interview because he was sitting in our toilet. Because we have a bidet at the studio, and he was just like, what the fuck is this? And he came in like 3 or 4 minutes late. James, do you have a bidet, James?
I think we know the answer. I've never used it. I didn't realize that the studio has the capabilities.
Oh, we do. I have one in every bathroom in my house, too, as well. I can't.
My friend,
I think I've pooped at your house before. Now I'm going to do it. Now we're going to really go into it. Pandora's box is goddamn open, baby.
Dude, you got to get meta, and you got to set the bidet to stun and then poop and then just let it fly.
Oh, I've done it.
Excuse me.
Stun? So you can start the bidet while you're shitting instead of waiting until after the shit. Also, I have a heated seat, one with heated water. Like, I don't fuck around.
Me neither, buddy.
I give you an hour on bidet. Let's move on. Okay. So then also during the pandemic, which I'm impressed with, which look, you are a guy that is known for pushing boundaries technologically, musically, but you really embraced the virtual concert with unique angles and really made it where you could probably get away with not touring as much because of all the effort you put into those. And I'm sure that those things were all kind of intentional to see how this works, because old man Townsend doesn't want to go out as much.
You know what? I wish I was clever enough to put those two things together. I think the practical reality of it is I was trying to figure out how to pivot a career, you know? And I think that I think you can compound that by this, by the fact, and this is, I'm thankful for the pandemic for a couple of things, strangely. And one of which is it really laid bare some of the reasons why I do things. And I realize how much of my self-worth was based on like people pleasing. And I'm not necessarily talking about the concerts, but just in general, like you're always trying to make sure everybody's okay. You're always sort of doing the dog and pony show to try and make sure that, you know, you're likable or you're sellable or whatever. And I think that I can be forgiven for that to a certain extent, because the industry up to the pandemic really revolved around like, you have to be present, you have to do the meet and greets, you have to do all these things in order to be relevant, to the point where you stop questioning it. And then when it ceases to become a part of your reality, there's this weird tailspin that I felt I went into. It was like, what do I do? How do I navigate this? How do I support the family? How do we do this? And I think that on a worst case scenario is what I just described. And on a best case scenario, I was really intrigued by the technical sides of it. I was really intrigued by, how do we make these works? How do we problem solve this to the point where it can function? The end result was perhaps I would be able to tour less, but I wish I, again, was smart enough to have had that as an intention in the beginning, other than just panic, right?
Yeah, like, figure this out. So now
I'm like, holy shit, man.
The first time I, along with most people, which it's amazing because it's 30 fucking years ago next year, have heard of you, was when Steve Vai put out the Vai record, and it was Sex and Religion. You were the singer. I'm going to be honest with you. Okay. So I came from I'm a couple years older than you, as we said, and I worked in the, lack of better words, hair metal world, right? I ran, I was a DJ and promoter at the Limelight on Sunday nights. And I, you know, that's where my bread and butter was in the Motley Crue, the White Snakes, the Skid Rows. That's where I grew up. Right. And I knew Steve Vai as Whitesnake's guitarist and then Passion and Warfare, which was very palatable to my tender ears, right?
Me too.
And then Sex and Religion comes out, and I'm going to be honest, dude, you fucking scared the shit out of me. I'm like, what is going on with songs like, you know, Down Deep Into the Pain and stuff with this wild look, crazy vocal ranges? And then I didn't really embrace it until the chick I was doinking, you know, James, how much I love that word.
He loves that word, for Christ's sake. I mean, it's insanity.
It really implies a small penis, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's fine. I'm fine with it.
Thank you for pointing that out. No one's hung going, I'm doinking abroad. No one's like, I doinked like so hard. Who's got several inches? No porn stars like doinking.
Right. I'm like a light switch, right?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it all. But she tells me, you know, you got to hear this record. It was her new favorite record. And then I decided, all right, let me sit down with this and realize that, holy shit, it was really ahead of its time. And it still stands the test of time in a lot of ways. And you were a child, really, for the most part. Were you 22 or something at that time? I don't even know how old you were.
Younger than that, man. I met Steve when I was still 19, I think. Maybe just hit 20, right?
Wow. That's crazy.
A couple questions for you. Okay, first off, I got to know what your hair was like.
Oh, down on my ass. I was a real ridiculous looking. Hold on. I'm going to bring this up. I don't know if it's going to come across on the phone. If Shannon was here, it'd be better. But let's see this. You ready?
Well, hold on. Yeah. Oh, dude.
Is that the best? Man. Look at that nonsense. Hold on.
I got one more nonsense. But this is with, speaking of 80s metal, this is with Taiketto and Biohazard.
Yeah. And
look at me here. Hold on. Look at that.
Okay. So how quickly did you transition from Skid Row to Pearl Jam?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So I worked in as a DJ at Limelight. The wild thing for me was it was okay to play both for about 2 years.
It was a wild time.
91 was a beautiful. I always use the Last Action Hero soundtrack as the the template for that, because it was a little bit of everything on there. Right? I was like, okay, to have AC/DC and I think Alice in Chains like on the same record without people going, what? You know, and so there was like a year or two transition, but I built my radio show 8-10 years later. I started in 99 on the idea that I missed Guns N' Roses and missed Van Halen and Motley Crue and Skid Row and, you know, all that shit.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I did that. So I loved Pearl Jam and Nirvana. I loved it all, but I missed the party rock vibe, the let's get drunk and get laid vibe of the 80s rock. That's what I missed. I'm being honest.
Well, I remember because I moved to Los Angeles in 91, and it was right at that point where all the spandex overnight was replaced by like oddly sweaty Pacific Northwest jackets and the brand new Dr. Martens, and you know what I mean, like the whole works, right? And I remember thinking at the time it was preceded or right after that, where that look immediately turned into Green Day and Rancid, and everybody was like, okay, well now we're punk rock, and then, you know what I mean, and there was always this kind of immediate need to follow whatever aesthetically was working. So I got a lot of respect for the fact that you were holding firm.
Oh, dude, I kept my hair long till way beyond it was cool. Like, I think I cut it. I was on a show called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy in 2003, and that's when I cut my hair. That's a long time after.
How about you, James? Did you have the hair as well?
I did, but I got this hairline too, baby, so it gets in the way. Too, when I moved, I still had long hair when I moved here in 06 to New York, but I used to have long hair. I was in bands and shit.
Yeah.
Grunge era. Yeah, when I moved here,
James,
I split
James
ends.
Can play
it's
guitar.
Disgusting.
And also, that's a difference. Yeah.
You know, that's great, man. I remember sneezing, I think, when I was 23 and it fell out. But when I was a kid, like the whole social collateral that had any value was your hair. But I always had shit hair. Like, it was never good. It was always too thick. And
I mean,
like,
you're
like
the man who rocked the skullet for a decade. You were proudly rocking a skullet.
Yeah, but that's because I'm tenacious, man. I wasn't letting it go, right? But it was, but more than that, I remember when I was in like 11th grade, I remember thinking, because, you know, my girlfriend at the time had a crimp perm. And I remember thinking, oh my God, dude, it looks like electricity. That's how I want my hair, right? So I was like crimping my hair. And then because I'm lazy, I was like, oh, I'll get a crimp perm. Clearly it will look forever. Oh yeah. So I went, got it. Next day it was just like this. It looked like a Q-tip. And I thought, okay, well, I can't cut it because of the effort that I've invested into growing this hair. I'll just brush it out. And so by the 12th grade, I had about 6 inches of greasy straight hair and this plume of like perm. Well, that
I just showed my hair. Do you have a picture of that anywhere? You don't have a picture of that anywhere.
Yeah, I could probably. Oh, dude, it's rough, but I'll find it here. Like,
so while you're looking, my the logical question about this is, I know you recently joined Vi on stage somewhere, and I know you're still friendly, and I know you don't like to look back much. That's part of what it makes you so unique. But is there, if Steve Vai said, hey, dude, hold on, let's see this picture first.
All right, yeah, that's what I bring to the table.
Oh, my God. Oh, wait, you look like, fuck, there's a chick you look like. What is that girl? God damn.
Barbra Streisand, man.
Maybe Barbra Streisand.
Well, I had the flock of seagulls.
That's pretty it, cool.
You kind of look like a new kid in like a Partridge Family or Brady Bunch
That's
episode.
Who he looks like. He looks like someone from Danny Bonaducci. Who? That's who it is.
Well, okay, you know what? This is a compliment to me, because if you were up close, here was the thing. Is again, personal grooming was always such a conundrum. I remember thinking, like, when I was 13 or 14, maybe a little older, maybe 30, that my balls, when they started to smell, when I hit adolescence, I was like, well, as opposed to just having a shower, what I'll do is I'll just put pit stick on it. You know, I mean, I'll put mm-hmm. armpit deodorant on my sack. And the only scent that I had available to me was lime. Not only did I look like Barbra Streisand, but my nuts smelt like an orchard, right?
Meanwhile, so with sweaty saltiness and the lime, you're like two-thirds of the way to a margarita in your pants. That's pretty cool.
Get you some Cointreau. Do we know if Barbra Streisand smells like a lime down there? Am I missing something?
The word on the street is yes, right?
Like, never lie.
So the question is, I'd have to ask, is like, let's say Steve Vai calls you and says, dude, next year, it's 30 years, we're going to do a handful of dates revisiting that record. Are you in or are you not in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, here's the thing. Steve's a friend of mine, and we have been a friend for a long time. I'm a idiosyncratic person to work with at the best of time, and I don't like hurting people's feelings. I don't like being unnecessarily cruel to people. And I find that when I'm in working relationships with people, because I'm so focused on what I do, I can be difficult to work with. And I don't value that as a personality trait. So I tend to just not impose myself on people. So if we were going to work together, I mean, I would be hesitant only because I would hate to react in a way that was petulant that he doesn't deserve, because he's such a good friend of mine. And I tend to be better friends with people than coworkers. You know what I mean?
Right.
If Steve wants to do it, of course I do it. I love him, and I've got nothing but respect for the guy in every conceivable way. But I mean, typically my track record for not being a twat is low, right? So
at least you know who you are, man. But you said the first half of that sentence, like, just say Canadian. You don't need to say about how you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. And
let's go into this. Let's go into this for a second, because you said this the same thing in the beginning of the interview about me being early, but then proceeded to give examples of a lot of people, including yourself, who are that way as well. So I would suggest that not wanting to hurt people is not an exclusively Canadian trait, because you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree. Okay.
But you guys are very, very friendly. And I have a lot of friends from Toronto, comedians, and I've seen them get in fights with each other. And then as the guy knocks the guy down who is clearly wrong, the guy goes, sorry. And even the way you say sorry, you put more letters in it than are needed. That's people who have empathy, baby.
Let me tell you something. I think a lot of that is bullshit. I think a lot of it's window dressing, and I think a lot of it's little brother syndrome, because culturally we've been indoctrinated to think that as our identity, we have to be polite, to the point where the politeness is this weird kind of passive aggressive surface that once you get past, I find in my experience, and Canadians paying attention to this may disagree, that a lot of it's just like, a very convenient cover for some really deep rooted hostility that we've never learned as a culture how to express. So when things do go south for us here, it's like this weird kind of, I don't know, maybe because it is like the little brother, you got the States, which is like the big force. And then you got a tenth of the population up top. And I don't know, man, I remember when Gene, Hoagland moved to Vancouver when we were in a band together. He's born and raised in Texas. I met him in LA. He moved to Vancouver and he was like, you know what? I remember him saying this. He's like, you know, I always thought of Canadians as being this really polite group of people, but when I'm here, you guys are really fucking got anger issues. You know, there's this sort of passive aggressive thing that maybe comes from years of being told that any overt displays of emotion are uncouth. I don't know what it is, man, but it's like I've spent enough time elsewhere to have Canada as a topical part of my personality. But I think, you know,
well, I would say this. There are some comedians that are so known as that passive aggressive that are Canadian, like Will Arnett, who are masters of being assholes in a kind way. So that kind of all makes sense. All right, before we go any further, you know your crit, and we talk about them forever. Well, they just launched not that long ago, Yo Delta. They are the new Delta 8 sponsor with everything you need to stay high and legally get it shipped to most of the states in this country. Delta 8 is something that's found in weed and can be shipped legally to most states across the country, and the most important thing is that it will get you high. Yo Delta is potent, so if you're living in a state where weed is illegal, you can constantly try to get a hold of your source, and he or she either wants to hang out too much or you can never track them down. The answer is simple. Go to YoDelta.com for high-quality lab-tested Delta 8 gummies and vapes that will get you really high. It's YoDelta.com. Use the promo code GAS, and you're going to get 25% off your entire order. Once again, the promo code is GAS for 25% off. Stock up on Delta 8 vapes and gummies only at YoDelta.com. All right, let's get back into it. To get back to it, because there's a lot to talk about with you. It's just amazing. I think it's 28 albums so far, whatever. But so you started playing guitar at a young age, you were 12, the Vi thing we talked about, briefly in a band called Wild Hearts, and then briefly did Irate with Jason Newsted, right? And then you're like, you know what? Fuck working with other people, as you said earlier, or I am a cunt or a twat was the word, I believe. So I'm going to do my own shit. You know, fuck this. I'm going to do my own solo record.
Yeah.
The wild thing. So it becomes, you know, Strapping Young Lad, but that was just a pseudonym that turns into a band. Heavy is a Real Heavy Thing comes out. And we will say it wasn't embraced initially by the heavy metal community. James, it sold 143 copies in the first 6 months. I think that's right. So people were like, what the fuck is this? But just like with the Vi, I feel like you were just ahead of the curve. Right. So
Very kind.
People came around to it. And now Trapping Young Lad is looked at as like the band that your favorite band in the metal world will tell you, go listen to that band.
Okay. I remember hearing a quote from Woody Allen at one point that he said, if you just keep showing up, eventually they've got a seat for you. And I always remember thinking that in terms of my creative output, it was similar to that. I think the thing I got going for me is tenacity. Like, I'll just keep doing it, and I'll keep, I keep showing up, and I keep doing my thing. And it's like pigheaded in the sense that if I have a vision and if I have an objective that I want to accomplish, I tend to find a way. And I think that that tenacity has yielded all this work more so than any overt plan. You know, like, man, I've got such a ahead of the curve vision here, and eventually people are going to catch up. I think I just was like, I'm going that direction. And if I get there, then there'll be a swath of chaos that will have been created. Right.
Where it goes to in that there's been so much what I would call just chaotic stuff. So we'll go with your I could be wrong if it's your second record, so I apologize. But your record, I think, was a like musical, a Punky Brewster, like a Muppet scene. I forget what the fuck. I don't remember. It was something bizarre musical. Not like, oh, let me do another straight up rock record. Let me just fucking take a crazy right turn or left turn, whatever you call it. That is kind of like the groundwork for not only Ziltoid, but now the new thing, The Moth, like that shows that that's where your head, that's part of your personality.
Okay. And it is. And I appreciate that. And it's the questions are wonderful. Thank you. I mean, The album's called Punky Brewster. It was actually the first record out, and it was a play on the topic that we brushed upon earlier, where people were transitioning from being one identity to another, depending on what was commercially successful. So it was about a metal band that turned into a punk band. It was written about the Green Day era, right? But here's the thing that is often misconstrued about the way that I create content, is that on some level, I'm doing it to be provocative. You know, like I make something and then I change gears.
Because I don't think that at all. I don't think that. I think that you're going by what's inspiring you at that moment.
100%. 100%. And I think that if there's anything that I've been able to base my career off, it's, in my humble opinion, the fact that it's, for lack of a better word, authentic. I'm doing it because it means something to me. And one thing informs the one that comes after. So if I do something chaotic, the chances of me doing something mellow after it are high, just because I'm fatigued. Like I'm, right. You know, it took a lot of effort to do that. So I go a different direction. Right.
And this is where I think James is going to definitely have insight on this, because as a therapy and, you know, dealing with mental stuff as well, him and I talk about it often. You look at music as a function of the process, and that when you're dealing with something, sometimes music is the best way to deal with that. And what I love about, I mean, the question you've been asked a million times, will there be another Strapping Young Lad record? The answer has always been, which I totally get, I'm not in that place anymore. So it would be disingenuous to just do it as like, hey, I can make money under an SYL record, but that's not who you are anymore. And the therapy for you is those songs and is those albums to process whatever you're fucking going through, good or bad.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? And I appreciate the awareness of that too. But I would hesitate to use the word therapy. I think that, you know, not to get too far into it, but I mean, shit, I've gotten in so far into it for so many years, it doesn't matter. I think that if you are coming from a stoic background where overt displays of emotion are viewed as being inappropriate or uncouth, and you can find as a hypersensitive person, which you're just born as, that there's a loophole through some sort of artistic medium where you can express those things, that it's like socially acceptable to do so. Then I think if you are wired to be sensitive and interpret your environment in a very visceral way, it becomes less of the process is less about creating music and more about an exhaust of trying to maybe not actualize yourself. But
the term you used that I liked was unfuck yourself, which I think makes sense.
Yourself.
And James, that's what I'm going to ask you. Am I right to assume most comedy comes from fucking pain and misery anyway? And that's why you're doing that. Is that fair?
I think really good comics do. And if you see someone, you're like, yo, this guy kind of sucks. They're not too painful. Yeah, it's kind of like, I'm a comedian. I'm doing what comedians do. But most of the good people, even if their act doesn't seem personal, there'll be underlying shit to it. Even when I do crowd work, there's an underline of 44 years of getting punched in the fucking mush.
Okay, so two thoughts on that. First off,
I like punching the mush, by the way.
Straight in the mush, baby. Yeah. I don't get boinked.
For me, mush is the stomach, though. My mush is my stomach right now.
Oh. I like to think it can be a number of things. It can be a conglomeration of stomach.
Mush was face growing up.
Yeah, man. I like it. But I think that if you realize the ways in which you are fucked up and your objective is to not remain that way, then I think you've got a really difficult decision to make, because it's like, okay, so if I've created an identity and a financial obligation to a family by being able to represent that, the less fucked up I am, the less it's going to appeal to that demographic. And the second thought of that is, now when I watch Bill Burr, I find it really interesting, because it seems like he keeps becoming less and less fucked up. Right. And it seems like as he's changed, he did a bunch of mushrooms, he had a kid, he's like, he seems to have like an awareness of his anger and all these things. When you see him now, the thing that I think was so compelling about his comedy in the beginning was this kind of like off the cuff, relentless, you know, like anger that was just perpetually coming out of him. And now when I see it's not as much there, I wonder, gosh, how does one sustain that? Like, how do you shift that?
I think that's why so many artists in general, comics, musicians, whatever, when there's massive success, since a lot of it comes from that place that we're talking about, and then all of a sudden that's not a point anymore. It's not driving you. It becomes harder and harder to be creative.
Then what do you do? And I think this is exactly where a lot of people find themselves around the ages that we're at as well, because it's one thing to consciously recognize the ways in which your actions that you are now able to cognize are causing you undue suffering. It's one thing to recognize that, but it's then you're stuck with to take steps to remedy that. What's that going to do to the art? What's that going to do to the demographic? Right. What's that going to do to the bottom line? Right.
My other podcast co-host Big J talks a lot about when a comic can write jokes that he knows will work for the audience, but he doesn't like it. Like it's like pandering. Mm-hmm. Like Jay tells the story, James, sure, you know, like in his early days when he was working mostly black clubs, he would hump the chair and he would get naked and he knew it would kill. But he tells us, he walked off stage, and I forget who it was. It might have been a towel. I don't remember who it was. Looked at him and goes, "What are you doing?" Like, he thought he was killing.
It's probably Keith Robinson.
Maybe Keith Robinson. You might be right. Yeah. And it was the awareness of, oh, this is just pandering, and it's not actually me furthering myself as a comic.
That's the choice that I think people have to make, because there's some people are like, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with it. And I think that what it comes down to is what your intention is, like, honestly. And I think that you have to be clear about that self and the pandemic about that. And I think the pandemic offered a lot of us forcibly opportunities to see the ways in which we are our actions, you know, manifest in our work.
Right. Of course.
And then you're in this position where you're like, OK, well, what do you do? What's more important to you? And I think that's a position that a lot of people get to. I often think about Slipknot, for example, or I use Slipknot more of an example than Metallica, just because they're a lot more visceral, right? Mm-hmm. At least nowadays. But all these guys are worth a fortune. Like, the singer for Slipknot is worth a fortune, and he's got kids and he's got real estate and he's a happy dude. I read a thing about him the other day saying, I'm the happiest I've ever been. And I'm thinking, but when I hear the new music, and I haven't listened to it enough to analyze it, I think to myself, God, that's got to be a hard thing to get
into that place, to find that place, or without it feeling like I said, completely fake and bullshitty,
but without having to do things to yourself to cause yourself unnecessary suffering. Because what's the point of doing that? Like, what is the point of doing that?
You're finally in the place that you wanted to be your whole life, and now you're taking a giant step back just for the art, which is kind of weird.
But then, conversely, how much of an obligation do you have to the people who put you there?
Right. It is an odd question. James, you look like you have a thought on that, James.
But we could do, this could be a mini series. There's just this topic alone. We could do 19 parts of this shit. Yeah. They say Andy Kaufman didn't go to therapy because he was scared of losing his edge. And there's so many people who are scared of that. I've had that fear in the past. It's one of those things, man. You see people who reach a certain success and then they start writing just to that audience and don't evolve as an artist. You have to be brave enough to fail or take a half a step or a full step backwards to go to where you're supposed to. The key as humans is for us to want to evolve and become the best person that we're supposed to be in that moment every passing day. And as artists, the same thing. But so you have to remind yourself that there's a chance tonight when I leave you guys with these two shows, I might take a step back. But if I take a look at why I step back, it's going to lead me to where I'm supposed to go. And that's where you're supposed to go, and not just the anger. I've been more angry on stage and it's been working because I lost a friend and I got my heart broken. But
and
in
you
3 weeks,
to deal
I might
with
not
me once
have those same feelings. So I have to evolve to where that's going then.
Right. Exactly. 100%. So let me just to get back to some of the music stuff. I have to get that in there, too. Because you do take so many left and right turns in your musical career, and you've openly discussed sometimes a new album is going to come out, like they'll say Lightwork is probably, which we'll get into in a minute, one of the more, I'm going to use the word mainstream palatable. I don't know if that's a wrong way to put it, but that album you've put out in a long time. Do you find that, A, you know sometimes, oh, this is not going to be embraced by my fan base as much, but you're doing where you wanted to do it. Does that ever crawl into your brain as to maybe direct you? And then the second question, it's a two-parter. When you look back on your wildly different music, is there one that now at 50, whatever, that you are not proud of or you wish you could take out of the Devin Townsend discography?
First part of the question is yes, every time. It's a huge part of it. And I think my inclination to follow the creative impulse where it leads is autonomic. So I don't feel like I have too much control over it. So I have to follow where it's the compulsion leads. It's otherwise, I mean, it's not interesting. And the workload that goes into actualizing this stuff is so much that if you're not interested in it, it's a fucking gong show. So I have typically just committed to the fact that every release I'm going to have that neurosis prior, just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is coming out. Shit. You know, I mean, here's a country record. Here's a new age record. Here's a orchestral thing. Here's a death metal thing. Here's a whatever. Right. And it's so I have to just factor that into the process because it's unavoidable. And then second, is there an album that I regret? No, because they're all indicative of the same process. And that process is, I mean, I wish I could say otherwise, but it's pretty ignorant. Like my peripherals are not, you know, I don't know what's going on until I'm at the end of it. Like usually I'm able to, you know, it's almost a reductive process where you're like, okay, so you've had a moment of emotional significance. I'm constantly writing. You try and find one piece of music that on some level illustrates what that intangible emotion was. And then you start to fill in the blanks. And by doing that, you start to remove things like, okay, it's not that color. It's not that type of font. It's this sort of thing. And then by the end of it, you're just like, oh, I'm angry. Or, oh, I'm sad or whatever. Right. Or like, I don't know.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You touched on it just now, so I'm going to bring it up. I heard a rumor that there will be another quote-unquote country record, Casualties of Cool. Is that a reality, or is that just a hearsay?
Well, Che and I are really good friends, and if we have anything to say, then yeah, of course, but we may not. Like, a lot of times when we get together, we just hang out, and it's like, you know, we made the first record in 2014, and here we are. Basically, the process of that started a decade ago, and since that record, we've written half a song, and we've spent tons of time together.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So maybe the crossroads that we met at in the beginning is where our creative catalysts lie, but who knows? You know, we're getting together this weekend, and maybe there's more there. I hope so. You know, we're good friends.
One other side question, and then we're getting into light work. So, sure. Apparently, again, I don't know if this is true. I try and do my research as you could possibly
I can see. It's great.
That you were asked to be at least audition for Judas Priest, and you said, fuck no. Is that right?
That's a romantic way of describing the situation. Technically, yes, that happened, but it wasn't like they were knocking down my door. Basically, they threw out a blanket thing to a bunch of singers, Worrell from Nevermore, myself, mm-hmm. Couple other people, and I was a letter with the
logo.
Oh my God, dude, it was
that's
like as
fucking
a
cool as shit. Let's that's go. Cool,
dude. You know, like Unleashed in the East was the shit for me, right? And so to have that was, but I also remember thinking that singing was this thing that happened to me because of my involvement with Steve, because I never really set out to be a singer. I learned to sing because I was a guitar player, and most of the singers I auditioned, I didn't relate to, right? So I thought, okay, I'm going to learn to sing until I don't have to fucking sing anymore. And then here we are so many years later where it's kind of my deal. But as a result of that, the technique that I had was so shoddy that had I gotten to a situation with that level of expectation to sing like Rob Halford, dude, you know, I would be crucified, right?
That's funny. So, that's cool. Yeah. All right. So now, we had Alice Cooper on like right in the middle of the pandemic, and he made this comment that, boy, there better be a lot of fucking great music that comes out now while all musicians are home and they got nothing better to do than write records. So you decided to embrace that in a way that First, there were the double of the puzzle and snuggle, right? Puzzle and snuggle. But the interesting thing about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, like you started with Lighthouse is the new video. We'll get into that. But you started with that, but realized your brain wasn't ready for it. So then you did these two other records almost therapeutically to bring you back to light work. Is that relatively correct?
Technically, yeah. A couple of thoughts about it. Number one, I loved hearing you say snuggles. That was adorable.
I'm a snuggly guy, sir.
I can see it's amazing. So a lot of times what I've seen post-pandemic, if you want to look at it that way.
Let's hope we're post-pandemic, right? For God's sake. Right?
They're saying, what do you bring to the table? What have you done when you're at home? And I did a shitload of stuff, but I view what I did during the pandemic as a detour in a sense. Why do I view it that way? Because the things that enable the creative, compulsion to be really on fire is experience, right? And the experiences that we had were really monochromatic. It's like we were at home. There's like all this anxiety and all the stuff with your parents and your friends and people dying and, you know, people, I'm sure it's the same with you, as people in my life that were in my life that are, they're no longer in my life. There's all this shit that happened. So the emotional components of the pandemic, although intense, were really monochromatic. It was like this amber sort of thing. And so the output that I had created was based on the same process that has always been there for me, just trying to sort of purge the experiences with it. But when I listen back to this music, it's really a specific identity, and it's hard for me to even articulate, but it's different than what I would suggest maybe Alice Cooper was saying about that. There's got to be really good music coming out of it. A lot of the best music for me happened from experiences that were less gross than that.
Yeah, fair enough. But also, like, but even so, in true Devin Townsend way, you know, and I could be wrong, but this also, but I think the puzzle had like a graphic novel with it. And like, there's, it's not just, hey, I'm putting out a record. There's more to it. And it always seems to be the vibe with you. Like, I know the Moth musical project that you've been working on for years is going to be some sort of interactive thing. It's not just a show, there's more to it. It always seems to be, oh, let's just push it a little further,
you know. And this is not being self-deprecating, I guess it is, but it's like I'm trying to keep a more balanced perspective on it. When I hear you say these things, it really comes across like this is some sort of master plan that I've got, like some sort of heavy intention, you know. I mean, it's going to be this interactive thing, but it's not, man. A puzzle wasn't either. I'm just like, I think it's going to be an interactive thing. And I think it's going to have a graphic novel. And then the further I get into it, I'm like, oh, yeah, it has to have a graphic novel. Why? Well, because the concept is about a bunch of people having different perspectives on a similar experience and how your bias and your past trauma manifests into how you perceive the world. And so in order for us to do this, we're in a practical time in history where there's a lot of artists going through the same thing. So if we have different people do it, what are their mediums? And so the lack of peripheral vision that I mentioned earlier is the same thing that leads me down these rabbit holes. And I don't have a master plan. I just go with it until I think clearly that's a part of it now. Clearly that's a part of it. And often my first thought is not like, oh, this is fascinating, I can't wait for this. My first thought is like, oh, fuck, how are we going to afford that? You know what I mean? So yeah. It's like, and so with the Moth, I mean, the best way for me to write any of these things, whether or not it's light work or the puzzle or Moth or Ziltoid or strapping or whatever, is to just try to think about it the least I can and then try to keep my shit together as a human so that when I do sit down to create, it's unfettered by a lot of my baggage, right? Of which there is a lot. So,
right. And then I always wonder what a Devin Townsend project with unlimited resources would look like. It'd be a very funny thing. But so now we have to bring up the new record, right? So it's called Light Work. And in the newest video, Light Worker is focused on a light worker meeting an octopus, a tribute to Ron Dass, if I'm not mistaken. And you say music, it's in a way, it's a metaphor because it was your lighthouse during the pandemic. Music was what help keep you centered. And now in the effort of saying there's always one more thing, there's a companion record called Nightwork, and I don't even know much about that, but it just shows you that in a way I'm kind of true. It's always one more thing, and that's fascinating that that's the case. But what is Nightwork? And I know also the tour got delayed, and we don't have too much more time with you, but I want to get into this a little bit.
Well, I mean, I just keep writing, man. And it seems like certain things make sense and certain things don't. And I just do it. And it's like, you know, when you're sitting around with your buddies and you've had a couple of drinks or you had a toke or whatever, and you're like, wouldn't it be cool if, and you start saying, oh, and then we do this thing and then we got it. And there's like, you know, monkeys bicycling around on a thing and then we can drop a shark or whatever. It's like you just, and you riff on these things. And then typically after it, everyone's like, ah, it was funny. And then you go back to your day, right? Like, I've always really been fascinated with the idea of like, oh, let's make it happen. Like, let's see what would happen if we did that. If we had the coffee drinking alien, then we make a puppet show out of it. And then we make a big show out of it. And then, and the impetus for that is just because I think it's fun. That's it. And so the whole idea of making Nightwork and Lightwork, I mean, one of the interesting things about being interviewed in the ways that someone in my position gets interviewed after a record is on some level, you have to think about why you did it. And then you come up with all these kind of retroactive, creative rationalizations for it. But it's all kind of just bullshit, man. It's like, I really like to play guitar. I really like, I've got the facilities and to do all these things on my own. And so I just do lots of stuff, right? And it's there's metaphors to it, of course, but like, for example, Lightwork, I didn't know like Lightwork was about until last week. And I was like, oh, that's why it's chill. Oh, because it was been a fucking fucked up couple of years and I didn't want to hear anything. It was brutal because my whole world has been just chaos. So when I sit down in front of the computer to work, I want what's coming out of the speakers to like, at that point, at least, as opposed to maybe sometimes in the past, it's like, that's what I needed right then. But I didn't know. It wasn't like I sat back prior to writing Lightwork and said, well, the whole objective of this is to create some sort of metaphor.
Right. It's like, but even like, by the way, like your autobiography, Only Halfway There, that was released with an acoustic record, right? I mean, it's like everything is always, well, let's just see what else we could fucking do here.
Okay. Well, I had a point. I'm sorry to interrupt because I guess that's my deal, right? But it's like... my reason for the one more thing all the time is because I'm an imperfect perfectionist and I want things to be perfect all the time. I want everything to be perfect and it's not because I'm not. And if I ever did get it perfect, there would be no more one more thing. I'd just be done, you know?
So I know James has to leave in a couple of minutes. I want to wrap up with a couple of other quick questions before we do the first. I think we could sneak it all in, James, unless you want to do your plugs, James, and run. I want to be conscious of your time, James.
Hit it, baby. Hit it. Do your thing.
Okay, so I don't
quit
know.
It, baby. Look.
First of all, you started a podcast and stopped after 18 episodes. I assume that was a moment of craziness during the pandemic. Let me just do something. Am I right with that?
No, I moved and it kicked my ass. Moved during the pandemic and I had to build a studio and renovate and it fucking kicked my ass.
Right,
and I couldn't do anything up until like now.
All right, fair enough. And then is this book yours? Because if it is, I have a very similar thing. I know it's under your moniker, but I don't know if you put it out. It's called Don't Disturb Me When I'm Listening to Devin Townsend. Do you know that book?
No.
Okay. So the title of the book is Don't Disturb Me When I'm Listening to Devin Townsend. And the whole book is just a journal. It's blank. And I thought it's like a brilliant, it's just a journal. It's just to have a journal. Like for people that want to listen to your music in journal, I saw it online and I was like, I wonder if he put this out as a goof because you do silly things. But it's not you. Someone stole your name and put it out, man. I would look into that.
Nah. I mean, it's
you better be Canadian passive aggressive against them now. You got to figure out who it is.
So no, how would that go down? I'd have to be like, oh, nice book. Yeah, it'd be a shame if you put it out under somebody else's name who isn't collecting any royalties from it.
There you go, baby.
No, man. No, it's got nothing to do with me. But honestly, it's like I get mails from people all the time where it's like litigious mails where they're just like, dude, they're using your logo. You should get out of them. And I'm like, fuck, man, I got to mow the lawn, man. There's so many things that require my energy in a day that I'm like, yeah, how is that really going to change the course of my of my work, you know, like I can't imagine. And if that guy, because clever enough idea, if he sells 10 copies of it, I'd be surprised. And I think that's worth it.
His side, good man. For him. All right, fair enough. Yeah. And then lastly, the album, there is some sort of actual hard album that's coming out, right? Because the album is available on Spotify right now, Lightwork. Mm-hmm. But the actual, like if somebody wants to buy, because your fan base would want to do that for sure. Yeah. Is that coming out or is that out? Is that Heavy Debbie?
Didn't see the midnight release at Tower Records on Sunset there? Or like...
Is there one isn't?
No, of course. Yeah, there's all it's been out for maybe 2 weeks. But yeah, it's like, where the frick are you going to get it? I don't even have one. But I think it's like apparently they're in the mail and apparently they're available somewhere. And we put tons of work into the packaging and everything. But a lot of the reasons why that is the case as well is because that's part of the process for me. I enjoy it being great. But if no one gets it, my main objective really is to continue. It's not, you know, like if I became super successful, it'd actually be really difficult for me because then I'd be too conspicuous. Right. Like if I could just keep doing what I do. And you said you'd be a menace with a lot of money. Yeah, I'd either be a menace creatively or you'd never see me again.
Yeah, one or the other. And the tour is being postponed till next year, right? There was going to be a Lightwork tour that's coming out. You had to postpone it sometime next year, right? No.
Well, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I just got back from 3 months of tour recently. So I don't know if that's technically what that postponed one was. But the next one's in February in Europe. And then we got North America and then Australia.
Oh, that's cool. And then lastly, kudos to you, because I mean, I could be mistaken here also, because I do make mistakes a lot. The girl you met when you began dating at 19, you're married to now, right?
Yeah, man. We ran out of things to argue about 15 years ago.
That's pretty wild. That's really wild. That's fucking congratulations. Talk about you going against every rock star norm on the planet. The only other one was when we had the original lead singer of Styx. What the fuck is his name? My brain is farting right now, but he came
on.
Dennis DeYoung. Dennis DeYoung was with his high school sweetheart his whole life, which is pretty wild.
Well, I couldn't imagine. Like, I've had two relationships in my life, and it's not because I don't like being in a relationship. I mean, of course, you know, I do. But it's also like, God, like, I can't imagine. Like, if someone said, oh, you know, my buddy, for example, he just got a divorce. And he's just like, you know, my other friend is just like, man, it must be great. You're out there playing the field. And he's like, you know, I thought it would be great. I thought it would be great. It's like, you know, I maybe get to sleep with somebody new or whatever. And I thought that would be really cool. But he's like, man, I realize at the age of 50 how much I couldn't be fucked with other people's hopes and dreams that I don't already know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was in two relationships on my way to this interview. So we'll but we got to do the first and then get out of here. The name, we're going to do the first right now and then we'll get out of here. James, you got time to squeeze that in?
Do it, baby.
The first time.
The name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We've asked every guest this question since the dawn of time, their first experience with all three. We start with rock and roll. The first concert you ever went to doesn't have to be rock, but the one you went to ideally on your own volition and not some stupid Canadian band we never heard of.
Oh, God, you know what? I'm so glad that you bring that up because I haven't seen a lot of Canadian bands, to be frank. The first real metal show I went to was the Injustice for All tour with the Cult opening. Mm. And that was monumental for me. And I fucking loved it, man. It's like,
how old were you?
Probably 15, maybe.
That's
maybe
awesome.
A little younger. Yeah. So I mean, cool. Before that, I'd seen Johnny Cash and whatever, but it was like, yeah.
That works too, bro.
But it was Metallica was the first one. Pardon me?
That works too, bro. Johnny Cash works.
Johnny Cash is awesome.
Be proud of that one.
So good, man. With June Carter running circles around him, it was amazing, right?
That's fucking cool.
Now it's even better. Better. What else was Waylon playing guitar? Let's keep adding to this. It keeps getting better, dog.
Yeah, man. I could retract and Willie Nelson, man. Yeah, it was like a whole crew, Rick Conn.
They brought him up on stage. The first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed was not the first drug you ever did.
Mushrooms.
And how old were we?
I started late. I was probably 23.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I figured you did mushrooms and then you wrote Ziltoid in a night. That's what I was
Mushrooms, I think, were right around the time of Strapping and Ocean Machine and all that. And they were also, but Infinity after, that's where I started taking acid, was like responsible for some of the least clever life choices I've ever made. That even now in hindsight, I'm walking up to people like, I'm really sorry.
And what about the first time you had sex?
I think the first time I had sex, I was 18, and I think that was actual intercourse, but actual sexual interaction.
We usually go by intercourse. We usually mean actual penetration is what we're looking for.
Okay, but the first sexual experience was hand in hand with Def Leppard's Hysteria, which is why I have such a soft spot for it.
Oh.
But I think that
if it involved your hand, it's definitely not sex.
Oh, okay, then I have to negate that. First actual sexual experience, I was sick of being a virgin. So I was with a girl at that time, and I was like, all right, I need to lose my virginity tonight. And I was working at a restaurant, so I brought home the ingredients to make some sort of shitty fettuccine, and then, you know, we had awkward sex. And then from that point on, I remember thinking like, wow, my writing has just changed. That was actually a tangible difference. Like directly after that, my handwriting, everything changed, man.
Maybe it's the fettuccine.
There's
something in the goddamn Alfredo sauce.
Well, and it was prawn. Somebody says that, you know, your flaccid penis looks like an uncooked prawn. So maybe there's something to do with that.
Now I'm hungry, everybody. Okay, so now the new album Lightwork is out now. You can follow Devin Townsend at Devin Townsend minus the E and the I, DVN Townsend on Instagram, or heavydevy.com without the A. Everything's got to be more complicated with this man. You can follow him there. The new album is Lightwork. Anything else you want to plug before we go around the room?
You guys are great. I really appreciate this interview. I really appreciate the questions. They're conscientious and thoughtful, and I really appreciate that. So thank you so much. It's good to see you.
That was very nice of you. James, your plugs?
The James Mattern Pattern with an M on Instagram and YouTube. You can watch the special, The Check Spot. You can listen to it on Spotify. You can buy it at pinchrecords.com on vinyl. It's the shit. It's album of the year, according to Interrobang. And I'll be with Chris DeStefano at the Paramount Theater New Year's Eve. And I'll be in Vegas December 20th through 26th at the Comedy Cellar. My hometown and my home club
converge.
Whatever. I gave you enough.
New Year's Eve with DeStefano. That's what you're doing?
Yeah.
Right before midnight, 11:58 p.m. is my birthday. I want you to give a shout out. One moment of silence. Ralph Sutton. Woo! Happy birthday.
Well, Chris is going to be on stage for that shit. I'm warming him up. I do 15 minutes of fucking around.
Interrupt his act. I don't give a fuck. All right, so
interrupt his act. Bubba, I'm going to be trying to find a kiss at that night because the person I thought was coming is not anymore, baby.
Beep, 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 beep. Follow me over at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast that is on health and wellness comes out every Monday. We're opening up our first location in New York City, 3rd Avenue, 69th Street. It's called Good Sugar and the Good Sugar Podcast. As far as a story, we had a song. Shannon's not here, but we're going to ask it anyway. Shannon has a podcast called The Thing Is, I will not say the other word, on bad dates, fighting, and ghosts. And we always ask our guests at the end of this, don't reply until we dig in, both of us, our answers. Does Devin Townsend believe in ghosts? No. I'm going to say, James, absolutely not. What do you say, James?
No.
No. Do you believe in ghosts, Devin?
I don't know. I
That's a yes.
That's a push. No,
I don't. Okay, I don't know.
I don't. Okay. No. Okay. Because I don't give a fuck.
Okay.
But
that's a no.
But I, yeah.
Imagine, by the way, imagine you ask a girl, do you want to have sex? And she goes, no. Like, that's an open-ended no. I don't know.
Well, here's the only reason I hesitate is because there's people I know that have no reason to lie to me that have had experiences with it. And so it's like one of these things where I don't care and I've never experienced it, but no, he really did. So, and
as long as they believe it, it's good for them. All right. So
it's
a push. We add a song every week to the sdoshow.com/playlist. I'm going to pick the one off Lightwork that I feels a little different than the rest of the record. We didn't have time to get into it, but we're going to play Heartbreaker. It's a little longer. It's a little more aggressive, but I dug it. We're adding it to the playlist. Devin Townsend, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you,
James, thanks for squeezing it in because I know you're running the fuck out of here. And we'll see
all
everybody
good,
next
thank
time.
Thank you, guys.
On the SDR.
You guys are awesome. Thanks for the
SDR for life, baby. DT, life. Word up, bro.
Bye-bye. 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 We'll be right back.
Listening to the SDR Show.